remember your name, 'cause there ain't no one born to give you no pain.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. This week, Jeff Godsoul takes another look at one of Michelangelo Antonioni's classics from the 70s, while Hallie Z shares some thoughts on one of her not-so-guilty pleasures. But first, Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time finds much to ponder in the new documentary about Nazi cinema, Hitler's Hollywood.
Germany, in the middle of the 1930s, Hitler's domination had stabilized. The regime's enemies had been silenced, exiled, arrested, murdered. If there weren't already Hitler supporters, most Germans had adjusted themselves to the regime. Cinema offered an additional distraction.
Released in 2018, this is the third in a series of documentaries by Rüdiger Suchland and his examination of German cinema in the early years of the 20th century. Now, his previous two films were inspired by the work of Sigmund Krakauer, and especially his book, From Caligari to Hitler, which examined the cinema of Germany through the 1920s and up to when the Nazis took over. Now, this third film, Hitler's Hollywood, as you can tell by the title, is about the Nazi film industry.
Nazi cinema was theatrical, filled with illusion. It was bigger than life. It wanted at all costs to be monumental, a spectacle, something for the heart and the eyes, but haunted by ambivalence.
Now, many people will banter around the name Joseph Goebbels, who is the head of the Nazi propaganda ministry. This film really looks at what they were doing, how they presented people, what sort of stories they presented. One interesting thing is there were no real fantasy films or a horror movie, nor were there any science fiction movies, you know, inventions and going into space or anything like that. The Soviets were making films about going into space, but here in Germany, it was more important to get everybody in line. And surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, one of the major themes throughout these movies is death, and especially giving up your life for the good of the fatherland. And that's something that appears in a lot of these films, and that they go over that. There's not too deep a look into the Hitler films, but it is a nice sort of introduction. So you see who the actors were, you see some of the movies that were made. One of the most notorious was one, The Internal Jew, Jew Shushed, I believe it is the title. And I was saying there were no horror movies. This one is essentially a horror movie. It's kind of like a Dracula movie in its way, the way the evil Jewish man is like spreading his evilness around this town until the good citizens finally rise up and turn against him. And the actor who was playing the lead character was sort of vilified for the rest of his life for doing this. And so we get into that. We also get into a number of interesting actors who stayed in Germany, especially the wonderful Hans Albers, who was so popular that even though he wasn't a Nazi, the Nazis put up with him and allowed him to live, you know, outside of the system and do movies occasionally because he was so popular. But there's also, surprisingly, Ingrid Bergman had made a couple of movies in Berlin. And it's sort of interesting to watch these films set in Berlin, shot on the streets in Berlin there in the mid-30s. And here's Ingrid Bergman before she went over to Hollywood. But there were also a number of other actresses who were very interesting. Lillian Harvey, Bridget Helm, she'd been the robot woman in Metropolis, Margaret Helscher, as well as a character, Else Werner, is probably someone who could have gone to Hollywood, as they see in her performances. But so it's an interesting introduction to propaganda, but it's also an interesting look at the cinema that was being used for definite purposes. There's Leni Riefenstahl, The Triumph of the Will is shown, as well as the Olympian movie. And here we see the individuals just being absorbed into the mass. We have people at first we see, you know, with their shovels and their picks and stuff. And then later it's all just the torchlights and arms and legs marching around. And there's only one individual, and that's Hitler. Also surprisingly, there's a number of films in here which are sort of feminist films. There's one about a woman photographer, and she wants to become a nice, you know, photojournalist. And sort of it's interesting to kind of see here this woman trying to make a career in something that's usually done by men. Of course, in the course of the movie, her like greatest achievement is she's finally at some place where she gets to take the Führer's picture. And so there's that's in it as well. And so I'm talking about a movie that's out on disc. It's called Hitler's Hollywood. Now, there seems to be a British version and an American version. The American version, Udo Kier, the cult actor, and you know, he was in those Andy Warhol Dracula and Frankenstein movies and a number of other stuff. He does the narration. Unfortunately, the music in the background seems to overtake it here on the American disc. The clips that I'm playing here are from the UK disc.
Many hours a second look, a look that focuses on the details and disregards the surface message without losing sight of it. Some films disclose more than the makers intended. The best of them are self-reflective and reveal something beyond themselves. What are these films about? What do they reveal? And what are they hiding? It wanted to be a second Hollywood.
So this is Hitler's Hollywood from 2017, directed by Rüdiger Schützlund. I would hope that he goes on to do another film on how Germany recovered after the war and what sort of films were made after that. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about that Robert Sidomack film from 1959, The Devil Strikes at Night. And you compare that film and what they showed of how people's lives were, the sort of, you know, their apartments and the streets and the cafes and stuff, as opposed to the idealized life as shown in these Nazi films in this nice little documentary. It's not too deep a documentary, but it's a nice overview. It goes over the actors, goes over the movies, and shows what was made, shows how things were done. One film that's talked about at the end is this movie, Kohlberg, a big, epic Napoleonic war film about a town that held out against Napoleon. And supposedly, they wanted to premiere the movie in Kohlberg, but the Allies had already taken it by the time the movie came out. And so a print of the film was parachuted at night into the town so it could be shown while they were taken over by the Allies. But that's not in the film. We're more looking at the actors, the movies, the themes of the Nazi films, especially giving up your life for the fatherland. And now that's reinforced through these movies. So this is a very interesting overview look on the Nazi cinema. This is Hitler's Hollywood from 2017.
Thanks again, Matthew. And now, let's hear from Jeff.
By the mid-70s, it had been over 10 years since Michelangelo Antonioni had made a film in his native language of Italian, and 8 years since his last great success. It wasn't a stretch then to suppose that he might not have that much gas left in his tank. I certainly didn't think so at the time. Not after the misfire of Zabriskie Point and the detour of his 3.5-hour documentary on China, Chung Kuo. But Antonioni had one more film to make on his 3-picture deal with Carlo Ponti and MGM, and one more masterpiece to make. He would make films after The Passenger from 1975, but for all intents and purposes, the Antonioni era ended with The Passenger. You can look at the film as the continuation of his style and thematic obsessions, or the culmination of the same. It is possibly Antonioni's most minimal film, and that's saying something for someone who loves long takes and little dialogue. The Passenger was shot on locations in Algeria, London, Munich, Barcelona, and across southeastern Spain. And Antonioni makes full use of every one of them. As with all of his films, The Passenger is visually stunning, in keeping with Antonioni's treatment of the environment as every bit as crucial as the movements of his protagonists. The Passenger opens in the heat of the Sahara Desert in northern Chad. An American TV journalist, David Locke, working for a British news service, is doing a documentary on the region and hopes to conduct interviews with the rebels fighting the government in the Chadian Civil War. Little is said and less is accomplished as he is led through the desert by various guides. Unsuccessful, he heads back in his jeep, only to get stuck in a sand dune. He half-heartedly attempts to dig himself out before just giving up, throwing his shovel against the jeep. "All right, I give up," he yells to no one. Only the flies and the hot desert wind. Jack Nicholson is David Locke. Nicholson was a hot property then as an actor, but not yet the superstar that he would soon become. Although released in early 1975, The Passenger was mostly shot in late 1973. After Five Easy Pieces, Colonel Knowledge, and The Last Detail, but before Chinatown and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Nicholson was eager to work with Antonioni, and their collaboration led to a friendship that lasted until Antonioni's death in 2007. Nicholson knew that Antonioni doesn't use actors the same way other directors do, and being a child of the cinema, he was more than willing to do his part within Antonioni's vision. Sometimes it's interesting just to watch people be on film. But it's a lot more interesting when they're in an Antonioni film. And it's hypnotic to watch Nicholson as reporter Locke trudging back to his hotel room in utter despair. And, of course, there's no soap in the shower. Locke had struck up a casual conversation earlier with an Englishman named Robertson, whom he had met staying in the room next door. Upon visiting his room again, he finds that Robertson has died of an apparent heart attack. Robertson has a strong resemblance to Locke, and in his present existential state, Locke decides to switch identities with Robertson. Robertson was a wanderer, a globetrotter. The only clues to his identity, and there aren't many, are the conversations that they had, which Locke had tape recorded. His personal possessions only contain an appointment book with various names and places, an airline ticket, and the number and key for a locker in the Munich airport. His ruse now a success, Locke leaves the hotel in the desert and Robertson's body with the local authorities and heads to Munich. Meanwhile, in Britain, his death is eulogized by his colleagues at the TV network where he was employed. His wife, although having an affair with another man, is guilt-ridden and wants to know more. When she learns that he'd been seen in his last few days by this man named Robertson, she determines to find Robertson and enlist the help of the friend of them both, a producer at the TV studio. Locke arrives at the airport in Munich and finds inside the locker some manuscripts with photos of all kinds of armaments with prices to match. He's observed at the airport by two men who soon approach him in a church where a wedding has just been performed. They ask for the documents, and Locke obliges. He is then handed an envelope with a large sum of money inside, with the instructions that the second half would be paid to him in Barcelona. Robertson, it appears, or now Locke as Robertson, is a gunrunner.
Robertson is involved in illegal arms traffic in our country.
For the same rebels that Locke had been trying to interview in the Sahara.
I just sold 5,000 hand grenades, 900 rifles, and a great deal of ammunition to some people fighting a secret war in an obscure part of the world.
This rather implausible scenario unfolds with quite realistic believability, but despite its resemblance to a Hitchcock thriller, the passenger doesn't put our protagonist in any great peril, or at least not obviously. But if it does have suspense, it's the kind that comes from life itself, and it's not without humor either. Nicholson is just the kind of actor who can express the wry humor in everyday situations, including this one. And so it's off to Barcelona, where Locke notices that the TV producer, Martin, has tracked him down. He enters the foyer of a seemingly random building, which just happens to be La Pedrera, one of the famous buildings by Gaudi that can be found in Barcelona. He encounters a young architecture student there, played by Maria Schneider. They strike up a conversation as they wander through the amazing structure and its striking rooftop. Locke is surprisingly truthful with the young girl, explaining that he's being followed. He asks her to do him a favor. It's the only person he can ask to get his things out of his hotel room for him, so he won't be seen. To get the hidden jewels and the secret documents, she says. Something like that, he says. She agrees, and although seen by Martin, she eludes him in Locke's rented convertible. And off they go, now together, on their existential road trip. The passenger is full of coincidences, including the fact that Locke had actually seen the girl once before, back in London, also reading a book, on a bench. It is as if Antonioni was saying there are no real coincidences, and that these events really comprise what we would call fate. It's also been thought by some that the passenger of the title refers to the girl, but screenwriter Mark Peplow makes clear that it was always intended to be Locke as a passenger in Robertson's body. Every location to which they travel is stunning, every shot marked by the composition which makes Antonioni's films so remarkable. Unbeknownst to Robertson, his rebel contacts in Barcelona have been apprehended by agents for the Chadian government, and now he's being pursued by them as well as Martin, and soon joined by his wife, Rachel, as well. Things get darker, and fate eventually catches up with Locke in a small hotel room in a remote village in Spain. And in a long 7-minute tracking shot, better to be seen than attempted to be explained, the passenger and Locke's life come to an end. Let me just say that this long shot required ceiling tracking, gyroscopes, and precision timing. And that a lot of it would have been made a lot easier with a Steadicam, but they weren't invented until just 1 year later. Due to a contractual obligation from MGM, the rights to the passenger ended up going to Nicholson himself. He kept the film out of circulation until Sony Pictures Classics offered to restore it and reissue it in 2003. In his wonderful, if somewhat sparing, commentary, one of two on the DVD, his reverence for the film and for Antonioni is obvious. He speaks in a kind of hushed voice as the action unfolds, in a marked attempt not to break the hypnotic spell that this remarkable film can cast. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to drop into Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for even more recommendations. And you're listening to Film at 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Next, Holly Zimrocek joins us to discuss one of her great enthusiasms. So we're talking once again with Holly Zimrocek, and we're going to be discussing one of your favorite movies called Event Horizon. Now, this movie came out in 1997 and stars Lawrence Fishburne, Jolie
Richardson, yeah.
Jolie Richardson and Kathleen Quinlan. It's directed by Paul W.S. Anderson, who's currently most famous for doing the Resident Evil movies, of which I think there's about 17 now. The script is credited to someone named Philip Eisner. The cast play the crew members of a spaceship that turns out to be haunted. Is that giving away too much?
Well, they're actually part of a rescue mission to go retrieve the crew of the Event Horizon, a ship that had gone missing. So they're kind of like the Coast Guard of the galaxy type situation, and they're going to go see what's going on with this Event Horizon ship. And yeah, it's been some dark places.
Do they find anybody alive on the Event Horizon ship itself?
Essentially, the ship's gone to another dimension and has come back. And the crew is missing and presumed to still be in that other dimension.
It is 25 years old, and it is celebrating an anniversary. And a lot of people are coming forward and saying, hey, this is a great movie. They complain about it having been badly mauled in the editing room by the studio or the producers. And so there's this great but unrealizable hope that that lost footage would be discovered, but it hasn't yet. And numerous articles popping up on the internet praising the film and the cast and yearning for haunted spaceship movies to make a return, although I can't really think of all that many. Among the ones they list are things like Life Force, which we discussed on the show a couple of weeks ago, Jeff did, and maybe Alien and that series, but those are really, they're monsters, they're not...
Yeah, they're more monster movies. They have more like dark horror elements, and they have like horror aspect that's more typical of the horror genre, but that's the thing, that the evil is physical form. It's an alien. It's, and a lot of the times these things are taking place. Another thing that article mentioned that you sent me was that a lot of these invasion type situations are happening on Earth. This is happening like in the deep darkness of the whole movie just feels very void and eerie. And the cast is so great. Like, I felt like they were a crew that had been doing this job for many, many years. Just so much eerie. Oh God, I love it.
Well, let's talk about that. Why else does the movie fascinate you?
I think it's this idea of interdimensional travel. And I think sometimes we think of other dimensions as being maybe, you know, similar to Earth or a mirror image of life on Earth. And I think this plays more with the other dimension as potentially hell. And there aren't actually too many gory elements in the film, but when they do happen, they're very purposeful and they mean something. And I really do kind of love watching people slowly go crazy. in a horror movie, there's always the one or two people, nobody believes them. And I guess that's maybe the most familiar trope in this movie, if I had to pick one. Otherwise, it's very original. Sam Neill character that is starting to act funny. He was the Dr. Weir, the engineer of the ship they're going to see. So the reason he's brought on this rescue mission is because he was the builder of the ship and he knows the ins and outs of it. So, you know, the rest of the crew is like, this outsider. And then he starts acting weird and everyone's like, oh God, something's wrong with him. And, you know, but Lawrence Fishburne, you know, he plays the amazing captain who has his stuff together and he plays it cool, you know? And he's like, yeah, something's Dr. Weir. Like, we're here to do a job and get out of here. Like, what's going on? It's my favorite line ever from Event Horizon is further along in the movie. And he says, where we're going, you don't need eyes. Oh, so good.
One movie that the Event Horizon reminds me of at the far end of the artistic scale is Tarkovsky's Solaris. And the reason that they seem similar is that in Solaris, the ocean planet that they're circling has the ability to somehow get into the minds of the characters on the ship and give them not just hallucinations, but actual physical manifestations of people they miss or are wondering about. And in Event Horizon, the evil that's on the ship is also able to manipulate the minds of the crew.
Yes.
Bella.
What is it, Stark?
I ran the bioscan, the DNA, RNA filters. The results were bio readings.
Of an indeterminate origin, yes, I know. Don't you have anything useful to tell me?
I've got a theory.
Let's hear it.
I think that there's a connection between the readings and the hallucinations, like they're all part of a defensive reaction, some sort of immune system.
I don't have time to listen to this.
You have to listen to me.
To what?
I'm saying that the ship is reacting to us and the reactions are getting stronger. As if the ship brought back something with it, a life force of some kind.
What are you telling me, that this ship is alive?
You wanted an answer, and it's the only one I've got.
No, what I want, Lieutenant, is to survive the next 10 hours.
There is that similarity. I think the main difference between those movies, I mean, frankly, I found Solaris quite slow, not in a good way. You know, sometimes we talk about movies deliberately paced, which is code for this is a slow movie, but I'm still really enjoying it. But Solaris was just such a slog. Event Horizon is a movie that keeps you on your toes. And
I think you've made a pretty good case for the movie, but for our typical cable listener, why would you urge them to see it? I think it would be not the special effects, but the philosophical component of the film.
Yeah, like I was mentioning, it explores interesting concepts of interdimensional travel. It's just not like anything really out there. I mean, we have how many Marvel movies now? We have how many, oh, my wife got murdered, now I gotta take revenge movies? Like, this is a movie that is kind of a standalone. And I know a lot of people be like, oh, I don't like horror movies or I don't like sci-fi movies. I think that this movie really does perfectly blend those two genres very nicely together. So yeah. I think you've been hesitant. I don't think it's going to be too technologically advanced over your head from a sci-fi perspective. It's an hour and 30 minutes. It did get chopped to its life. There was definitely could have been a lot more drawn out moodiness, but it gets to the point pretty quickly and has fun with it. So,
and also it's, as you mentioned earlier, it is not particularly gory. There is some violence in it, but for people who are interested in science fiction for the ideas and the technology, I think that this would be a satisfying Saturday afternoon movie for them. It's unusually thoughtful in its way, but you have to do the thinking. The movie doesn't think it for you.
Yeah, it definitely plays to the viewer's emotional intelligence. It just assumes that the viewer is going to get it. And that's the beauty, I guess, of having the internet these days. If you don't understand something that's going on in a movie, you can always Google it.
That's absolutely true. Well, we've been talking to Ali Zimrocek, and with her major endorsement of Event Horizon, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary right now. So thanks for joining us, Hallie, and Aaron Gilbrach.
What does that mean? Oh, are you speaking Irish to me?
Yes.
Gaelic?
Yes.
I was like, that sounds Gaelic. Okay, cool. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so enjoy your vacation in Ireland. Again, thanks for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
Community Radio,
KBOO, Portland.
Hello, cable listeners and galactic beginners.